This week on Your Western Context, Trudeau faces calls to bring Afghan interpreters to Canada. BC's 150th anniversary of Confederation is forgotten, and Alberta calls for pepper spray. Also, Carolyn Bennett's former staff detail the sabotage she has done to Indigenous relations. This is Western Context, episode 229, recorded Friday, July 23rd, 2021, Assault and Pepper Spray. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Western Context. Patrick and myself are back, as we are each and every week. And this week started off a little bit slow, but by the end of the week, we were able to pull everything together, and we have a full show for all of our wonderful listeners out there.
Yes, indeed. And as we move further and further into summer, we hope that people are enjoying the summer that they were not able to do last summer. And of course, our thoughts are with the many people across BC and in the prairies as well that are having to flee their homes due to wildfires. We certainly hope that those situations will resolve themselves with minimal loss of destruction and life to homes, of course. And we are going to talk about a lot of these stories this week that kind of flew under the radar and did not really get as much coverage in the media as they should have.
That's right, and that's the whole purpose of Western Context, why we exist, and we've been here doing that each week since January of 2017. And it's something that makes its way into the media, whether it's on print, on TV, online, anywhere you read your news, you'll find bias and sensationalism. And our podcast aims to remove all that bias and sensationalism. And in doing so, we want to put you, our listeners, on the right side of the news. And this week, we're going to begin with one of our Canada stories, a story that really didn't get too much coverage, but is something that all Canadians should definitely take stock of. If you want to follow along with us, you can find our full show notes at westerncontext.ca. And this story is about the impending withdrawal of the American troops from Afghanistan and what that withdrawal could mean for the Afghan interpreters that served our military and served the coalition's military for almost 20 years now at this point, and what's going to happen to them as the Americans withdraw. And the main reason for this, of course, is that the U.S. has set their pullout date in Afghanistan for September 11th, which is 20 years after the terror attack that began what became known as the War on Terror. In the aftermath of the announcement that the U.S. was leaving the country, the Taliban has been on a push and occupies more than half of the country. With the U.S. gone, one wonders what will happen, whether the Taliban will take over again or if the country is destined for civil war. Canada, of course, has had a very extensive mission in Afghanistan that started with Prime Minister Jean Chrétien, spilled over to Paul Martin and Stephen Harper, and of course had a ramp down under Justin Trudeau. Our mission, of course, would not have been possible at all without local interpreters and guides. These people and their families now have targets on their back placed on them by the Taliban, and those Taliban soldiers are seeking retribution for these people that helped the Canadians and the Americans and, in general, the coalition forces. Missions succeeded and failed in Afghanistan based on the interpreters. The difference between two words could mean the difference between a soldier pulling a trigger or not. Interpreters would also guide troops around, saying which roads to not go down, and in certain cases, point out where improvised explosive devices or bombs might have been placed. For the longest time, the Canadian government has dithered and seemingly did not have a plan to bring these interpreters to Canada. In doing so, and not having a plan, our government would have been condemning these people to death, and put frankly, that is not Canadian. Without them, the number of Canadians lost in Afghanistan would have been much, much higher. There have been calls for the government to welcome these people here to Canada, perhaps with the same vigor as Justin Trudeau's 2015 election push, when the media used the picture of Alan Kurdi to create fake news painting the Conservatives in Canada's existing immigration system as monsters. Or it could be with the same vigor as Justin Trudeau's infamous hashtag Welcome to Canada tweet after President Trump's inauguration. Today, though, we finally have the shell of a plan. Interpreters and guides, along with their families, will be able to flee to Canada as refugees and will be provided with, as the government says, a path to protection. The government estimates that the number of people eligible for this will be in the thousands. Details are currently scarce, but Immigration Minister Marco Mendicino said that time is of the essence and we expect the first arrivals to be in Canada very shortly. Defense Minister Harjit Sajjan, who himself served in Afghanistan, couldn't provide any direct details on this due to his words of operational security, but he said planning with coalition allies on logistics is underway. Now, in a Joe Warmington Toronto Sun piece, he said that taking no action could leave Canada with blood on its hands. And, of course, that's what columnist Joe Warmington said. And he's completely right about that. A lot of the interpreters involved are currently in active hiding, and if they were to come out, it would be a short order before the Taliban found them and killed them. Justin Trudeau and his government loves to use refugees as virtue signaling pieces. But we need to be 100% clear with this, that nobody has ever said there's anything inherently wrong with admitting refugees to Canada. But one thing that most Canadians should definitely agree with, that using refugees to score political points is just disgusting. The mission to save the interpreters and their families comes at a critical time, because with just over a month until the U.S. withdraws, they have recently carried out airstrikes to support Afghan forces. And put simply, the fight is not going well for the Afghan government. When Donald Trump was president, he was lambasted for wanting to pull out of the country, and there seems to be little concern with President Biden's plan. In total, 159 Canadians lost their lives in Afghanistan. The Canadian government, the U.S. government, and the original coalition partners should be having a very serious discussion about what we're willing to lose if the Taliban takes over again. Canada lost 159. The U.S., over 2,400. The U.K. lost 456, France, 89, Germany, 57, Italy, 53, and other coalition partners in total lost 321. That, combined with over 47,000 civilian casualties, should provide a somber discussion on whether or not withdrawing from the country is actually a good idea, or if the U.S. and our allies need to come up with another solution. The worst thing to happen would be for the Taliban to take over yet again, and for all of our work, money, and lives be put into that country for nothing. It appears that's the way Afghanistan is going, and saving the interpreters at this time is just one small thing we can do in a country that's going from bad to worse.
Yes, and one could say that the Canadian government has an obligation to those who have helped the Canadian forces do their jobs and to help provide stability in a country that the Canadian government decided that we would go into. And at the end of the day, it should be a no-brainer for the Canadian government to bring these interpreters into Canada. And not only that, but it should be a no-brainer that there needs to be a sense of urgency with this as well. Now, there has to be a lot of logistics going into the plan here to be able to coordinate a tactical withdrawal. But there also has to be time is of the essence, because this is not something that can just wait and wait, because these people are in danger, and they're in danger because they helped Canada. And I think that's something that the government needs to really remember, that the reason why the Canadian forces were able to do as well as they could is because of these brave interpreters and guides and people who were go-betweens between the two cultures, both the Western world and the Afghan world as well. And I think that's something that not many Canadians will be thinking of too much when they turn on the news, but it's something that if you ask people if they should bring these interpreters into Canada, not many people would say no. And I think that's something that Justin Trudeau and his government could have gotten on the ball a little bit sooner, given how apt they are to try and preempt the news cycle to try and get ahead of what the news are actually talking about. But it seems that once again, they're behind, and they're behind on something that is a very popular decision to make.
Yeah, and this is a story that if you didn't follow much of the military coverage on this, or you didn't follow anything other than the top stories this week, you wouldn't even know this was happening. But this has been an issue, not just for this week. This has been a known issue for the last month or two about what's actually going to happen with this. And the fact it's starting to appear and bubble to the top now is indeed a good thing. And time, as you said, is of the essence. And we just need to underscore how important this decision is to make and take stock at this point in time of what the general strategy about this is going to be going forward. Because it's not just the U.S. that poured countless lives and countless amounts of money into Afghanistan trying to win that war, which at this point it looks like the Taliban is in control of more than half the country. Everybody needs to have a discussion on this and say, are we happy with what we accomplished? Should we do more right now? Or are we just going to bring these interpreters in and treat this as a chapter that many people are probably not going to want to go back and look at in a historical sense?
Yeah, exactly. And this is something that it needs to happen. This is something that needs to happen, and it needs to happen sooner rather than later. And, you know, we have to look at the Afghanistan war in context and what our part in that was. And what our part was is that we need to support our allies. And that's not just our allies in the U.S. or the other coalition partners, but also it happens to be the ally, our Afghan allies as well. And so those that can make it to Canada, and we certainly hope that more of them, more of these interpreters are able to come here, that, you know, that is something that can actually happen. And like I said, it's not something that would receive a lot of disapproval, and it's something that should happen, as I said, sooner rather than later.
Yeah, and it's going to be something that people are going to look back on, and this is going to be a forgotten chapter of this war unless it starts being talked about more, and we definitely want it to be talked about more, and that's why it's on our podcast this week. And so many of our stories are like that. We can go back to any week and find a story like that. If you want to help us out with that task of putting together this podcast, you can do that by visiting westerncontext.ca/support or patreon.com/westerncontext and sign up for a Patreon page, where for as little as $2 a month, you can help us remove bias and sensationalism from the news and media. For $5 a month, you can continue to help us do that, and you can have your name read out on the podcast if you want. And for $10 a month, you can become a Western Context insider and gain insight into our work and gain pre-release access to our production and show notes throughout the entire week. And in case you're wondering what we're going to be doing with this, when we reach $30 a month in contributions, patrons will receive an exclusive monthly news article expanding on topical stories in the month. This article will continue to provide the context and the information you've come to expect from us. At $60 a month, you can expect a news and review podcast every other month, where we reflect on the news of the month in a candid way and provide opinion on where affairs are headed next. Secondly, of course, we do also have an option to make a one-time contribution as well via PayPal, which you can learn more about at westerncontext.ca/support. So with that being said, we're going to move on into our BC story as we look back at 150 years of British Columbia in Confederation.
Yes, and you would be forgiven for not realizing that last Tuesday was BC's 150th anniversary of being a province in Canada, having been admitted into the Confederation on July 20th, 1871. Now, many leading BC political figures at the time, including our what would become our second premier, Amor de Cosmos, who changed his name to the Spanish word that meant lover of the universe. He was a very interesting character, but he was fearing annexation from the U.S. at that time, and a lack of governmental structures and an overwhelming debt at the time, mainly caused by rapid growth because of the gold rushes. Well, they negotiated with the new Confederation of Canada to join in the start of what has been a fruitful and beneficial partnership for both the province and the country over that time. Now, oftentimes I see it said lately that with the rise of anti-colonial sentiment spurred on by the residential school discoveries, that BC should not celebrate joining Canada, or that BC should even change its name from British Columbia to something a little bit less British or Columbian. And to that I say those making those knee-jerk statements do not understand the complicated history of our province and just how beneficial we were to Canada and how Canada has been beneficial to BC in turn. Now, without BC joining Canada and negotiating to build the Canadian Pacific Railway linking the vast amount of unsettled territory in between, at the very least, everything west of Toronto would likely be American now. Now, while there are some that would like to see that happen, it is clear that our complicated history surely would not have been any less complicated under the American flag. So why is it considered taboo to celebrate BC's history or our very union with Canada? Well, mainly because many Canadians in the 21st century just quite simply aren't proud of who they are anymore or of what our country believes in. We've seen a major dichotomy with celebrations around the beginning of the month, with many Canada Day events being cancelled while just a few days later, south of the border, American Independence Day celebrations continued unhindered on July 4th. Now, after promising $30 million in this year's budget to mark the 1871 anniversary, the BC government has yet to announce details of who the money will go to or any events or initiatives scheduled. Now, the Ministry of Municipal Affairs, when asked about their plans, said this in a statement, quote, "We are consulting with stakeholders on the best way to deliver this program and expect to have more to say about this in the coming weeks. Now, while the history of our province includes many moments of progress, it also has dark chapters and a colonial legacy that continue to inflict pain upon communities to this day. That's why we're providing $30 million in funding to help local governments and First Nations to bring programs to light that educate people about our past, advance reconciliation, and promote inclusivity and diversity for the future." So when you read into what was actually said by the Ministry of Municipal Affairs, it looks like that $30 million in this year's budget to mark the anniversary is instead going to help educate people about what actually happened in our past and is going towards First Nations programs instead, which, you know, is not a bad thing necessarily, but it would be nice if they could just say that that's what it's going to and not that they had earmarked it for other things altogether. Now, no minister was actually available for an interview on how the BC government wanted to acknowledge the anniversary. The gap at this point between the funding announcements and actual concrete plans reflects the ongoing transition in many governments in Canada in talking about colonial history. Now, historians agree that Confederation was an important event in BC's history in a variety of ways, including ending the debate over whether the colony would remain independent or join the United States. It also gave the government financial stability due to Canada taking over debts, providing the railway, and this also led to a population boom. And at the time, they also ceded control over Indigenous issues to a different level of government, namely the federal government. Now, Dr. Kelly Black, who is a historian and executive director of the Point Ellis House Museum in Victoria, said that it, quote, "wasn't kind of a given that BC would even join Canada." Black said that, quote, "the particulars around how the province is structured and the jurisdiction that the province has over certain matters is all connected to the 1871 Terms of Union, and that we should be thinking about that as we think about what the future of British Columbia looks like." Black believes that BC's lack of discussion so far about its 150th year in Canada is a missed opportunity and believes that more funding for museums and conversations about the province's past are essential. He says, quote, "I don't like to use the word celebrate in connection with this history or this anniversary, but I think that we definitely need to reflect on it. If the province is not willing to recognize that it's time for an investment in these kinds of institutions and this kind of history work, then we're going to just continue to have a deficit of knowledge and understanding about the past." And that, at the end of the day, is the crux of the problem, that there is a lack of education on our past, not just in BC, but as a country, both the good and the bad. And those who are upset with Canada's past in dealing with Indigenous issues should look into how the Americans treated their Native Americans by comparison. Now, it's often said that Canada's number one national identity is that we are not American, so how would we feel today if these sorts of people took a time machine back to 1871, meddled with how BC joined Canada just to make themselves feel better? Well, they would likely return to the present day and discover that the entire North American continent was just one country, and that all that we know of in Canada was just simply a northern section of the United States. And, well, would that solve the problems that we have today? Well, obviously we can't change what happened in the past, and all we can do is learn from it and promise to do better in the future and to not repeat the same mistakes. Now, BC's founding, it's often being said, that was built on policies that were racist, colonial, and were not meant to actually help the Indigenous people. But they're not actually looking at what BC's founding was actually all about. And indeed, BC's founding was built on policies that aimed to do right by the Indigenous at first. In the 1850s, James Douglas, who was the governor of the colonies of Vancouver Island and British Columbia, and himself married to an Indigenous woman, made 14 small treaties over the areas that he was able to, and insisted that Indigenous people lay out their own reserves and have the same legal rights as Europeans, including the right to acquire more land. And Douglas had such an imprint on Vancouver Island that he has many different schools and areas named after him, and even the main street that turns into the Canada number one highway is still named Douglas Street that goes through the heart of Victoria even to this present day. Now, subsequent governors, premiers, and administrators then reversed his policies, and when BC became a province in 1871, there were 10,000 settlers of European descent, about 3,000 Chinese immigrants, and still some 50,000 Indigenous people, and yet the new settlers had slowly moved away from James Douglas's treaties and his well-intentioned rule, and had created what was known as the white man's democracy, where only European men had the vote. And their promised rule of law was used to imprison those who had persisted in the traditional potlatch, resisted colonization, and after the 1920s, it was used to force children into residential schools. Chinese, Japanese, immigrants from India, and black refugees from the United States also faced structural and blatant racism. Now, Squamish Nation Councillor Kelsillam said that any anniversary event should be rooted in education rather than in celebration. He said, quote, "Celebrating BC joining Confederation is a complicated and discomforting feeling for a lot of people, including a lot of Indigenous people. There were still a lot of discriminatory laws and policies that were targeting Indigenous people, and Indigenous were never meaningfully involved in BC joining Confederation." Now, it is impossible to know, but we can imagine that this territory would look like today if Europeans had treated the 40-some First Nations as sovereign bodies, as had the earliest European explorers of BC, just to name a few: James Cook, George Vancouver, and Bodega y Cuadra, who was Spanish, or if the land had been shared as promised by James Douglas. But what we do know is that at several junctions, settlers chose alternate paths devastating to First Nations. And yet today there are reasons to celebrate. Indigenous populations have returned to their pre-contact levels, their art and culture are deservedly world-renowned and celebrated, and their concerns are now at the center of provincial attention. And British Columbia is the envy of the world for our environment, standard of living, and our efforts to do better in combating racism. And surely there are reasons to mourn as well. As we mark this anniversary, the ongoing discovery of residential school graves are waking British Columbia to the inconvenient truths about our past and present. Most settlers are understandably appalled, while many Indigenous people are being re-traumatized. So how can we move forward? Well, one thing is clear, and that's Indigenous leaders have emphasized that recent acts of vandalism are harmful to their aspirations to bring us together on a path to reconciliation. One even said, quote, "We do not believe in dividing communities." And that's something that should be remembered, is that these people have lived through the harm done by attacking other people's history and know that there is no profit in disrespecting the histories of others. If the people of BC are wise enough, and the province is big enough to accommodate multiple histories, and we know that setting one story, one people, against another is the worst way to make progress together. Now, what is clear is that these criminal arsonists, for their very actions, are criminal, who are burning down churches and tearing down statues in BC and across the land, are not doing any favors for the indigenous communities across our country. Of note, just one day before BC's 150th anniversary of joining Canada, the St. George Coptic Orthodox Church in Surrey, BC, burned completely to the ground. Now, this church had faithfully served a multicultural background of Christians from many countries in North Africa and the Middle East, many of whom had immigrated to Canada to find a better life and to build a home here in our country after escaping religious persecution. Now, the total destruction of the Coptic Church calls for closer scrutiny. It was built by refugees who had fled religious persecution in their home countries, principally Egypt. Now, to flee from persecution only to have your place of worship destroyed in your country of refuge must be very hard to bear. A statement issued by the church after the fire more than suggests how deeply this congregation registered the event. And the bishop said, quote, "Our church was more than a building. It brought together a diverse congregation of Coptic, Eritrean, Ethiopian, Iraqi, and Lebanese Orthodox believers. The church was a haven where we practiced our ancient holy rites that have been preserved over centuries from our forefathers who keep the faith defying great odds. It was a place where we built community, where we shared meals, where we married our youth, christened our babies, and welcomed newcomers to the faith." One parishioner commented that the loss is heartbreaking, disappointing, and devastating for the congregation and the community. Now, after hearing such testimony, how can anyone continue to argue that they're just buildings or to maintain the rallying cry of burn it all down? Now, security footage has shown the true nature of the vandals. These vandals are not First Nations, nor are they doing this on behalf of First Nations. Many of the churches that have been targeted are situated on Native reserves, though it must be highlighted that Indigenous leaders have expressed both anger and dismay over these attacks. Some of the destroyed churches have served their First Nation communities for a very long period of time. No, it's clear that in response to the residential school announcements, far-left radicals have used this opportunity as an excuse to terrorize Catholic and other Christian communities by targeting churches. Now, while the arsonists of these churches have not been labeled as such, they could certainly be considered terrorists. Terrorism, after all, as we have previously defined on Western Context, as being the unlawful use of violence and intimidation, especially against civilians, in the pursuit of political aims. Now, is not the total destruction of these community centers and gathering grounds the use of intimidation against civilians? And if these arsonists are doing it in retaliation of the Catholic Church's reprehensible lack of recognition of any responsibility for the recent residential school discoveries, then is that not also a political aim? Yes, what these malcontents are doing is terrorism. But our politicians are silent on the matter. Justin Trudeau himself took part in two summits, one on combating anti-Semitism and the other on combating Islamophobia. Now, while no one should draw objections to such meetings or their intention of removing or at least reducing discrimination against either of these two religions, as far as can be determined, no scheduled summit dealing with the current wave of destructive hostility directed at Christian worshippers. Now, True North News has put up an updated map of the so far 53 churches that have been vandalized, desecrated, or burned to the ground in the last month, with more happening almost daily. And we have actually put this as our picture of the week that you will see at the header of this episode. Now, when this many Christian churches from coast to coast suffer everything from vandalism to full destruction, it is a huge national event that calls for extraordinary responses from both government and police forces. This is nothing less than a sustained, violent, and hateful rampage targeting a particular faith. It is a bigotry of fire, not words. But yet, on the political front, considering the scale of these events, the reaction has been utterly underwhelming. Rex Murphy, writing in the National Post, makes what he says is a truth that many don't want to hear. He says, quote, "A comparable sequence of attacks on faiths other than Christianity would call for an immensely more coverage than these have received, that politicians from all levels of government would be storming the TV studios and microphones to express their sympathy and anger, and that the police forces would be issuing daily updates on their efforts to find the perpetrators and put an end to the horror." However, so far, no such sense of urgency can be detected, either from the media or our political parties of any stripe. And that is worrisome, not just for Christian churchgoers, but for Canadians everywhere.
It shows a deterioration of law and order in this country. When the first church burnings happened a month and a half ago, we said here on this podcast that this was happening because we don't have a strong national leader to condemn these attacks, a strong national leader to unify Canadians, a strong national leader to understand and put forward a plan to make it so that the findings at these residential schools can be rectified and something of substance can be put forward. There needs to be an understanding, and that leader has to emerge. And this, in that own regard, can lead to a new understanding with Canadians, an understanding that Canadians can be proud of their country. BCers can be proud of their province, and so on and so forth, that it is not a stain to be Canadian or a stain to be a BCer. You could even say that any political party that runs in this upcoming election, should they put forward something that they could call a Canadian Pride Initiative to restore that feeling of patriotism and understanding of how this country was founded, would find supporters in all regions of the country. And this happens because of a lack of education about how this country was founded, how the country was founded in relation to that of the United States. Because if you compare, as we were talking about, Mr. Douglas in the creation of BC, and if you compare that to the American story of how they treated their indigenous people, the Trail of Tears, running them out of their territories and, in effect, butchering them. If you compare the two stories of that, you see that the two countries are very, very different from one another. And nobody tells that story. It's not taught in our schools. And it's rather unfortunate because the entire society we have today is built on the limit of 280 characters or short videos on TikTok or Vine or Snapchat. And the media has to cater to that attention span. And with that attention span, you don't get this deep historical understanding.
Yes, exactly. And there's no historical understanding of what had actually happened, both the good and the bad. What is happening in the past was an overwhelming focus on what good had happened, and a lot of whitewashing of all the pain and suffering that was going on from a lot of these marginalized communities. But now it seems we're moving the needle too far in the other direction, and that all we're focusing on is the pain and suffering, and there's no celebration of what brings us all together as Canadians and as a common people. And it seems that there's a lack of I wouldn't even just say Canadian nationalism. I would say, quite simply, there's a lack of pride and understanding of who we are as Canadians, both in people that have lived here for ages and in the newer immigrants that have come here, and in the Indigenous who have descended from those who have lived here for millennia. And I think that there's a huge total lack of understanding amongst our schools and amongst our adults as well, too, as to what had actually happened in BC and what has and where that led us to. And just the very act of BC not joining Canada back in 1871 could have had a huge ripple effect on the entire continent. And that alone should warrant more reaction. And I think that this is a huge story in the sense that nobody was talking about BC's 150th anniversary. Even myself, before I had read an article on it a couple days later, even I didn't know that it was BC's 150th anniversary. And that just goes to show the lack of respect that our history has in Canada. And I think if we learned more about our history and we learned more about what events happened in the past and where they led us to today, we might be able to learn from those and try and make sure that they don't happen in the future. And as we see within later story, a lot of these histories and a lot of this education and a lot of these different experiences held by different people are being ignored. And that's something that is just going to perpetuate the problem and not find resolution to what is happening right now.
It's a dissolution of the Canadian identity. And one of the things Justin Trudeau said when he was first campaigning to be Prime Minister and even Liberal leader is that he sees Canada as one of the first post-national countries. And we're seeing the results of that now. With no national identity binding people together, people are resorting back to those tribal factions that, or rather tribal tendencies, that don't do anything good for what we have in Canada. Canada is at itself best when it's united. And that is something that has been dissolved under this current government. And as a result, there's been much discussion about whether the provinces should actually start asserting more of their own autonomy over this. And this is something that we saw in Alberta this week with the call for the federal government to allow for pepper spray to be used for self-defense. And this was very prominent in our Alberta stories this week because one thing we haven't had much time to cover in the past here on Western Context is the unfortunate rise of hate crimes in our country. The federal government, of course, continues to vow to remove systemic racism as they see it from our society. But there's little hard action being done, but there is a lot of virtue signaling being done, which at the end of the day really doesn't help anyone. And going back to the last story on that, this is not what new Canadians want. If you look at any new Canadian who has arrived here in the last 20 or 30 years, these Canadians are some of the most proud Canadians that anybody can find. And this is what the Alberta government is aiming to protect, because in a move consistent with Alberta reasserting its independence, the province has called for the legalization of pepper spray as a defense mechanism. The province is also in calling for the federal government to impose mandatory minimum sentences on those who are guilty of hate crimes. In making this announcement, Alberta Justice Minister and Solicitor General Casey Madu said that it is sadly ironic that a vulnerable person carrying pepper spray for self-defense could quite possibly receive a longer sentence than her attacker. Now, the Premier also had words on this when he was taking questions earlier this week from a journalist who was concerned that people would just be, in his own words, spraying pepper spray willy-nilly. And in response, the Premier said it's a non-lethal tool for people to protect themselves from violent attacks. And I think it's perfectly reasonable. It's time for the Trudeau government to stump virtue signaling about the issue of hate crimes and actually crack down on hate crimes. This is a government that has widely repealed mandatory minimum sentences. Now, looking at this past month in Edmonton, a man received a 7-month sentence for 3 hate-related assaults, and with time served, that person would have been released from custody in just 35 days. The president of the Edmonton Police Solution sees making pepper spray legal as adding another difficulty for the job of police officers, but it's also, of course, worth noting that the law would still charge people if they used pepper spray as an assault weapon. Now, Irfan Chaudhry, who is a hate crime researcher and director of McEwen University's Office of Human Rights, Diversity and Equity, said that he sees pepper spray as ill-conceived and not very practical. He points out that it doesn't get to the root cause of what's causing hate-motivated violence in the first place. Now, For anybody who's aware of their history, you'll know that scapegoating is a common technique used to put aside fear of the unknown or a problem that doesn't have an immediate solution. And this, of course, can lead to hate crimes. Canadians, new and old, are concerned about the directions their communities have been taking. And Canada, at its heart, is one of the most accepting and diverse societies on this planet that anybody can find. But that doesn't mean that the concerns of one group should take precedence over another. Canadians who have been through three recessions in 2009, 2014, and the COVID-induced recession are at their wits' end. With economic hardship comes societal hardship. And this is not an excuse, but we need to look at who is being marginalized through the recessions, or whether it be new Canadians who are marginalized in their communities, or workers whose industries are being phased out by the Trudeau government. In any which way it is put, anybody who is marginalized in any way is more likely to commit a crime. In the meantime, all of those involved, from government officials to hate crime researchers to law enforcement, need to accept that we need to find a solution to this. It's unfortunate that our society has progressed to a point that we're at, but we need to be clear that one of the most important rights a Canadian can have is to a safe community. And as we see here, we talked about that in our last story with the church burnings and, of course, with bringing the Afghan interpreters to Canada. It's well documented in Canada that sometimes those defending themselves often face worse criminal sentences than those who committed the crime. Our laws federally favor the assailant and in most cases do not put the victim first. This is not something that Alberta can just change unilaterally, though. The changes would need to go through the federal government with an amendment to the Criminal Code of Canada. In an aptly titled Calgary Sun article, Trudeau, Pass the Pepper Spray and Hand Out Tougher Time, Minister Madu shared his thoughts with Rick Bell, Calgary Sun columnist. The minister pointed out that hate crimes could be related to a member of a religious group, a cultural group, an Indigenous group, a sexual minority, and yes, even a political group. He said, "Talk is cheap, it's easy, but these guys have not followed through with the actions on their commitment to build a safer community for all Canadians." He ended the discussion by saying, "If I come across the Prime Minister, as he has consistently done, working against Alberta's best interests, I will not hesitate to call him out. I have a solemn responsibility to go after anyone that takes our province for a ride. I don't expect to be popular in Ottawa." Now, with an election on the way, this discussion could get the ball rolling, but only time will tell if this is an Alberta issue or if others in Canada will feel the same.
Yes, this is something that is actually quite well related to our other stories, because, as you said, one of the most important rights a Canadian can have is to a safe community. And that should be underscored, is that a safe community should be held by everyone. And right now, the laws that we have in Canada for those who commit assault or even murder or other violent crimes, they don't really receive much punishment out of the deal. They get maybe a few years and get their sentences commuted, and they're released back into the general population regardless. And we've seen this very often with murderers and violent criminals in the past, where they don't really receive much. And the very idea that someone could use pepper spray to defend themselves against an attack and get receive more punishment than the actual attacker could is just ridiculous at this point. And I think that this is something, another story that really should be a no-brainer, but it's something that many people seem to think this is not something that should happen. And I think that's very confusing, in the sense that these laws should be protecting people, and they should be protecting those who are defending themselves. And the fact that we don't have that in Canada is really something odd to hear. And so it's good to see that this is happening in Alberta, and that they're making these changes that will help people to defend themselves.
The ability for a person to defend themselves, if you look south of the border, is a no-brainer. And any American who is listening to this, or any American who looks into how the law system works here, for cases of criminal defense is going to be scratching their head. And we need to be very clear here that the government of Alberta is not suggesting that we go all the way to what is accepted in many U.S. states, where concealed carry is legal and Castle Doctrine exists. Castle Doctrine is where anybody is effectively allowed to open fire on anyone who trespasses on their property after being warned to leave. Many U.S. states have this solidified in law, and based on some of the questions we saw in the media today, you'd think that what the Alberta government was suggesting was going that far, but no, they're just suggesting legalizing pepper spray, which is actually something that's very common in many European countries as well. So it's not too far out of the realm of speculation, and with an election on the way, potentially, it's something that all the federal parties are going to have to make their views known on as we progress forward.
And to make another note of this, it seems that everybody who is taking issue with this are males. Well, we haven't really seen many notable detractors of this idea from females. And there is a very real difference between men and women who, when they're out in a city or they're walking alone or they're coming home from work and they're walking to catch the bus or something, you know, there's a very real difference in how those people are being treated on that walk alone or and, you know, the very real differences that men and women have to face every day when they're going out and about. I'm not just saying that it's just women that are getting attacked by people or getting assaulted, but they're the ones that are really benefiting from this sort of thing where a pepper spray would be much more legal. And I know quite a few more women than men that carry pepper spray. And I don't think they're really concerned about laws to protect themselves when they're facing someone that might assault them. And I think this is something that a lot of these journalists didn't really go into. And interestingly enough, there wasn't much response to this on that. And you would think that for someone who touts himself as a feminist prime minister, as Justin Trudeau has many times before, he would know that this is something that many people will have different opinions on. And I think that's something that really wasn't focused as well by the media on this story, and that probably should have been.
Yeah, definitely, absolutely should have been, because there are a very large number of cases where we've actually seen this question of what exactly is acceptable and how far should the line be pushed in tolerating things happening in the workplace. And a lot of those have come into question with Justin Trudeau and his cabinet. And we have another one of those stories that just made its way through the media establishment very quietly this week, talking about Crown Indigenous Minister Carolyn Bennett. And that's her firing line this week.
Yes, exactly. And it seems that we can't go 1 month without a Trudeau cabinet minister having a scandal. And this time, it's Crown Indigenous Relations Minister Carolyn Bennett, who's a minister in charge of arguably one of the most important portfolios currently, what with the state that her country has been in this spring. Now, more than half a dozen Indigenous and non-Indigenous former staffers who worked in Bennett's office at various points between 2016 and 2020 have come forward to say that Indigenous employees were regularly sidelined by a toxic working environment in Bennett's office, but that their complaints fell on deaf ears. Now, at least one verbal complaint about the workplace environment was brought to the minister herself, while a separate verbal complaint went to her chief of staff, Sarah Welch. Now, three verbal complaints also went to officials in the prime minister's office, but they resulted in no action. One former ministerial staffer said, "Bennett, ultimately, the buck stops there, and she didn't want to hear about it." Another had said that, quote, "the office was very toxic. That affected the ability of the office to really move things. It could be toxic, and good people don't stay for toxic." And that is often the case when there is a famous saying that says people don't quit jobs, they quit bosses. And it's clear that many of these employees were wanting to stay and do good work, but their hands were tied when their ideas weren't being felt. Now, former staffers said that Indigenous employees in Bennett's office were marginalized and that their views were regularly dismissed, and they were often cut out of important decisions on their files. Now, Bennett's tenure in Indigenous Affairs portfolio is actually the second longest of any federal minister since 1966, when Indian Affairs became a standalone department. Bennett entered cabinet after establishing herself on the Indigenous file through her advocacy on Indigenous rights during the cross-country Idle No More movement between late 2012 and early 2013. Now, she was appointed Indigenous Affairs Minister in November 2015 and became Crown Indigenous Relations Minister in August 2017 when the department was split into two. Now, former staffers said that they believed that Bennett cared deep down about Indigenous people, but that they said that she wanted to execute transformational change, but that paternalism and a dysfunctional office environment got in the way of that progress. One former staffer said that, quote, she is very much convinced that of what the solution is, and that she has the right way of doing things, and that she looks down on anyone who doesn't see it her way. They were mentioning that the unconscious bias of Bennett's inner circle and its refusal to listen to the views of Indigenous staff had led the office to lose track of the political realities on the ground in Indigenous communities. And that sort of behavior allowed the office to be caught off guard by the First Nations protests that swept the nation in the winter of 2020 over the construction of the natural gas pipeline in BC. Now, one former staffer alleged that the Indigenous staff members' objectivity on issues related to missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls was actually questioned by Welch, Bennett's chief of staff. Another former employee said that an Indigenous staffer was told by Emmeline English, who is a policy advisor who was later promoted to the director of policy, that her people should just, quote, get over and move on from atrocities committed by Canada against Indigenous people. Now, that same Indigenous employee was also told by English that discussing a murdered relative during an internal meeting on missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls was not warranted, and this was also said by a former staffer who attended that meeting. And yet another one has said that a failure to listen to Indigenous employees had actually led Bennett into an embarrassing gaffe and conflict of interest in 2018 during the election for the National Chief of Assembly of First Nations in Vancouver. Now, Bennett's chief of staff, Welch, was told by a Indigenous employee that Bennett shouldn't appear at the Vancouver Convention Center where the vote was being held until after the Chiefs had selected the new head of the AFN. But Bennett did show up and met with Alberta Chiefs on the morning of the vote, which was won at the time by Perry Bellegarde. Now, that led to claims by many of the candidates that the minister was meddling in the internal policies of the AFN, and Bennett was actually forced to acknowledge the controversy in a speech to AFN chiefs after the election. Now, former staffers had said that Bennett had overestimated her relationship with First Nations leaders and relied too much on Bellegarde when it came to making decisions, such as choosing people for appointments. When staff had raised concerns about the minister's reliance on the AFN, they were cut out of files. And one said, quote, if you were a favorite of the minister, your policy files got pushed ahead to the front of the line, and if you weren't, they were just kind of sidetracked. Now, Bennett also took outside criticism from some Indigenous advocates personally, said former staff members. Cindy Blackstock, who heads the First Nation Child and Family Caring Society, has been a persistent critic of the federal government's ongoing challenge of a Canadian Human Rights Tribunal order to compensate First Nations children who were taken into the child welfare system. Now, several former staffers said that Bennett often griped about Blackstock, claiming that the First Nations child advocate was only doing so for, quote, her own ego. Now, former staffers also said that Bennett frequently complained about former Attorney General Jody Wilson-Raybould and former Indigenous Services Minister Jane Philpott. One former staffer said, quote, to me it seemed that there was a competition, that Bennett had to be better. Another said that, quote, she cannot stand Jody Wilson-Raybould. She saw Jody as a threat. Now, Bennett and Wilson-Raybould clashed internally over the direction of a signature government promise on Indigenous rights that was announced by Trudeau on Valentine's Day in 2018. Bennett ended up leading the file to implement the Indigenous Rights and Recognition Framework, which would have incorporated Section 35 of the Constitution, which affirms Indigenous rights, into other aspects of federal law. However, Bennett's department mishandled consultation on the framework, which was roundly rejected by First Nations leaders and later scrapped by the federal government. Now, the concept of the framework was developed by Wilson Raybould before she entered federal politics, and Trudeau then gave the file over to Bennett, who then bungled it completely. Now, at least 11 Indigenous people have entered and left Bennett's office since she was handed the Indigenous Affairs portfolio, which of course turned into her current role after the department was split. One said, quote, "When I got there, I quickly realized I was a token. I was there to attend events with her so that Bennett had a First Nations staffer with her, that she wasn't just bringing her white staff. My voice was never heard, my experience never mattered. It seemed because they were white and they had been to a First Nations community that they knew more and that they had better knowledge." And this has actually made it to our quote of the week, just because it so blatantly says the differences between what is supposed to be the governmental department that is helping Indigenous and what is actually happening with people within her own department that are actually taking care of these files. Now, this isn't even the first time that Bennett has been under fire recently. A month ago, Bennett had to apologize to Jody Wilson-Raybould after sending her a text message suggesting that Wilson-Raybould didn't want a federal election because it would imperil her pension, which is a charge that Indigenous MP described as racist and misogynistic. Now, Wilson-Raybould tweeted out a screenshot of a text conversation with a minister in which Bennett referred to one of Wilson-Raybould's tweets regarding the discovery of hundreds of unmarked graves at the site of a former residential school in Saskatchewan. Wilson-Raybould's tweet said, quote, "With the horrific news out of Saskatchewan, our collective call again is for concrete, transformative action. At Justin Trudeau, if you care enough to make things right, stop your selfish jockeying for an election, which no one really wants, and do what you promised in 2018. Bennett had texted Wilson-Raybould the tweet, along with a single-word message saying, pension, with a question mark at the end of it. Now, Wilson-Raybould shared the tweet, which the independent MP called racist and misogynist, and said that it reflects the notion that Indigenous peoples are lazy and only want money, and it also shows a disregard, disdain, and disrespect for Indigenous peoples, and conveys a message that strong Indigenous women are bad. Now, the president of the Native Women's Association of Canada said that the organization was deeply disappointed by Bennett's comments. Lorraine Whitman, who was the president of the Native Women's Association, said, quote, "Our relationship with the Ministry of Crown Indigenous Relations has devolved into one of dysfunction and distrust, and we have recently asked for a full reset. We hope that statements like the one made by the minister do not signal a further decline in that relationship." And there was also a lack of consultation on implementing the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People with the actual First Nations community. Now, earlier this month, the NWAC took a step back from Ottawa's efforts to draft a national action plan in response to an inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. The organization announced an action plan of its own, saying that it had informed Bennett of its intent to respectfully withdraw from the process due to the government's fundamentally flawed approach to fulfilling the inquiry's calls to justice. In response, the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs had joined a growing list of Indigenous groups and politicians calling for the resignation of Carolyn Bennett. Grand Chief Arlen Dumas said it very poignantly. He said, quote, "I think she should find other things to do. Those comments are very inflammatory. At the moment, we're discovering unmarked mass graves all throughout the country. That's what our minister should be focused on." The Union of BC Indian Chiefs has also called along on Bennett to resign, telling the minister that it is, quote, "deeply disturbed and disgusted by the extreme callousness, spite, and ignorance that you have shown through this racist message." Now, of course, Justin Trudeau took to the press conference to try and do damage control, and he said at the time that Bennett would remain at her post despite the calls for her resignation because there is, quote, "more work for her to do on the Indigenous file." Trudeau said, quote, "What Minister Bennett did was wrong, it was hurtful, and of course I am deeply disappointed. I spoke with Carolyn Bennett this morning. I know how hard she has worked and continues to work on this important file. I know her heart. I know the effort she has put in over the years on this, and we both understand there is now even more work for her to do. And I will know we will do it together." So, because Trudeau, whatever it means, is that he knows her heart, this self-sabotaging minister will remain on in a portfolio that needs the best right now at a time that is crucial for the future of Indigenous relations in Canada. Clearly, she needs to be replaced. And if someone who is that in a position to do that much damage, that there is a group of BC Indian chiefs that are disgusted by the extreme callousness, spite, and ignorance of the Indigenous Relations Minister, well, if an election is called, then I call on voters all across the country to help replace her and the Prime Minister that refused to do so.
You look at this story, and you look at all the ministers who pop their heads up everywhere, and every minister who pops their head up seems to have some kind of scandal associated with them, and the ones who don't are hiding in the background, and I guess they're not doing anything either on that regard that's helping. But this story in general, from top to bottom, got no coverage in the media. Had this been any other government, this minister would have hit the sack a long, long time ago. But because it's Justin Trudeau and one of his ministers, and it's the summer, there's no real push to do that. And, you know, from what we see here in the Prime Minister's office, this just appears to be par for the course, because pretty much any minister he's had who has a little bit of integrity around them has either resigned or not sought election again in 2019, or in the case of Jody Wilson-Raybould and Jane Philpott, they were fired. And that speaks to what everybody needs to know about how this government works. They can say what they want, they can virtue signal all that they want, but in the end, nothing changes.
Yes, this is exactly something that needs to be known by many of the people that are going to the polls in the next election, whenever it may be. Maybe Trudeau will actually schedule it for after October 21st, when the people that are elected in 2015, including many members of his own Liberal Party, are actually eligible for pensions themselves. But getting back onto the actual topic here, it's really quite surprising and amazing that Carolyn Bennett has been in this tenure for as long as she has, and that Justin Trudeau has protected her and has said that just because he knows the efforts that she has put in over the years and that there is lots of work to do, therefore she should remain where she is, regardless of how many First Nations chiefs and groups across the country actually feel about her. And the fact that they feel that she was being deliberately inflammatory and that she was callous and spiteful and ignorant about what she was talking about, those are very pointed words, and those aren't words that people will say lightly about someone. And that just goes to show that there is a no path of reconciliation with First Nations while Carolyn Bennett is in charge of this file. So it's quite clear that she needs to be replaced, and if Trudeau doesn't do it, then I certainly hope that voters will, because that is the only way to get rid of these sorts of people that are going to sabotage all of the work that Canadians are doing and are believing in when it comes to reconciliation. Because as we've mentioned, and as we've detailed in the previous stories, there's many problems that are going on right now, and we can't afford a government like this to bungle these messages and to bungle what's going on, because all as we've seen before, there's already too many issues that have been happening with Bennett's office in regards to people not being heard, people not being listened to, and even good advice that wasn't taken and resulted in problems, such as the election of the AFN president. And, you know, these are things that could have been prevented had the office of the minister been better off in resulting in what these problems, in resolving what these problems had come up. And, you know, this is something that could have been easily preventable had there been a more competent minister in charge. And, well, it seems like the competent ministers are now out of the Trudeau cabinet, and what's left are only the people that Justin Trudeau knows the heart of.
Yeah, and it really underscores what the entire existence of this government has been since 2015. People thought they were getting something else, but at the end of the day, it's pretty much the same old Liberal Party, except with a little bit more virtue signaling. And as a result, there's just been so many, I guess we could call political fires, but fires in general that have cropped up all throughout the country. And that's a good time to move on to our word of the week.
Yes, our word of the week this week is arson, which is described as the criminal act of deliberately setting fire to property. Now, it's unknown just how many of these wildfires that are plaguing BC and across the prairies have been started by arson, but certainly a lot of it could be carelessness due to cigarettes or to campfires, but you know, there's a lot of other problems that have been going on, and we certainly don't need, at the height of summer, where everything is as dry as it is, people to be setting fire to churches. And certainly we don't need our politicians to be setting metaphorical arson to all the problems that are going on right now, because making it worse is not something that needs to happen right now in this crucial time. We need a government that is able to make the right decisions and not to ignore them when they come along just because you don't like the person that said them. And we're seeing that so more and more often with the Trudeau government, that things are getting ignored just because they aren't being said by a friend of the Liberals. And, well, that's, it just goes to show the corruption and the cronyism that happens in our federal government. And if people keep that in mind when they go to an election, then maybe we'll see something different than what the polls are saying.
Indeed. And with that, that pretty much wraps this episode of Western Context. If you want full show notes or to read any of the supplementals from the story, you can find those at westerncontext.ca. You can also subscribe to the podcast on any number of podcast listeners out there, from Google to Pocket Cast to Apple and more. Just visit westerncontext.ca/subscribe. And of course, you can also find us online on Twitter and Facebook at Western Context. With that being said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.
And we'll always be sure to look through all the stories that the media will talk about and a lot that they don't talk about in the run-up to the week and the news that has been going on, whether it's TV, print, online, radio. We will find them, and we will give you the context needed to put yourselves on the right side of the news. So with that said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.